This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
So, hi, I'm here with Grant Munro, who's the manager at ESR Space.
Hi there.
Welcome to the Jodcast. Could you tell us a little bit about what you're doing at Blue Dot this weekend?
Okay, we're here this weekend to show off a bit of space hardware we have in our company that we're quite lucky to have, actually. And it's actually part of the Hubble Space Telescope, and it spent 8 years in space, during which time it orbited the Earth 45,000 times. Actually, we moved premises a couple of years ago, and this piece of hardware has basically lived on our clean room roof for all of that time in a box. And we just so happened to have a chance encounter with Tim O'Brien earlier last year, and he asked if we did any outreach stuff, and I said we do a bit, but Blue Dot sounded like a great idea, and I said we'd bring this piece of hardware along, and I checked with my colleagues first, so that was all right. And we brought it along, and it was a huge success, and I think one of the nice things about Blue Dot has been that you put in, you know, a certain amount of effort, and the return you get on that, the number of people that come through the stands, just absolutely amazing. We couldn't do that with any other sort of, you know, activity in quite the same way. You know, you'd have to visit a lot of schools to achieve that same reach. So it's brilliant, it really is, and it's a great event. The range of people is just astonishing, really, from toddlers through to some pretty hardcore festival goers.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a very mixed crowd in a fantastic way, really. So could you tell us a little bit more about what you do at ESR?
Yeah, so my role is to design spacecraft mechanisms. So as a business, we really have a focus on overcoming tribology problems. So that's lubrication, friction and wear issues. And in the space environment, in vacuum, that's a particular challenge. So my role really is about designing mechanisms that achieve a certain performance, you know, in light of that challenge. So we'll design mechanisms for often science missions. So we had a recent piece of hardware that was delivered for the SPICE instrument on Solar Orbiter. So that'll be launched, I think, early 2019 now. And that's one of 10 instruments on Solar Orbiter that's going to really enhance our understanding of the solar atmosphere physics. So as an engineer, it's not really my strength, but you kind of absorb some of it as you work on these programs. So it's a spectrometer, so it's looking at the different, it's amazing what they can determine from the data from these instruments in terms of sort of direction and you know, the dynamics of the atmosphere. It's amazing, really.
Yeah, no, that sounds fascinating. I bet you get to meet lots of, you know, fascinating researchers as well as part of it.
Yeah, I think more so at the start of the program, we did sort of meet a really broad range of engineers and scientists. Solar Orbiter, there's a lot of UK activity there. I think UCL have a big part to play in that. Yeah. And we've got some great solar physicists, I think, in this country. So, you know, I think it is a good mission for the UK, I should say. We delivered a mechanism to RAL Space down in Oxfordshire, who were the prime for the instrument. And then that was delivered, the instrument itself was delivered just a few weeks ago, really. And already it's been bolted onto the side of the spacecraft in Stevenage. So the whole spacecraft's being built in an Airbus in Stevenage.
Which is amazing, because I think I had no idea up until this weekend how much the UK was involved in the space industry.
Yes, I think it's often said that we're sort of unsung sort of heroes, but I think across science missions, and Hubble's a fantastic example. So many people think that is a NASA mission and it's purely NASA, but actually ESA have played a huge part in those huge observatories like the Hubble and like James Webb as well. I mean, if you look at James Webb, the business end of James Webb are the science instruments, of which at least two of those were wholly developed in Europe, and you know, it was a huge thing for European industry. So It's a really big project, and ESA are very much, you know, partners in that program. So I think we should always correct people when they talk about these NASA programs, because you know we are very much a part of that, and really at the sharp end as well.
Yeah, we kind of undersell the Europeans' involvement. Right?
Yes, yeah. I think that's probably true to some extent. Although I think engineers particularly fairly cautious about overselling stuff, you know, and with the type of work we do, where you're really dealing with risk, you have to be very realistic about, you know, the chances of success, and you do everything you can, but you certainly don't, you know, you don't count your chickens too early. So I think we are a little bit cautious in that respect.
No, and I guess you have to be. And one of the things that just blows my mind about anything that gets sent into space is that it pretty much has to work well the first time.
Yes. So yeah, I mean that whole process of making sure things work when they're in orbit. The Hubble's another rare exception in that it was serviceable, but the James Webb won't be. It's going so far away, and there are so many mechanisms that really have to work, and that reliability, the whole process of engineering is directed at that reliability at the end, and understanding how these things are really going to work and making sure they do, and that's really why our organisation exists, really. I mean, we've been working with ESA since 1972, obviously not personally,
yeah.
but we won a contract then to, you know, to look at developing lubricants and testing them. And that was around the time the very first European satellites. I mean, it predates ESA, in fact. It was called ESRO then.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, spacecraft have always had mechanisms on them. And I think they've always been a, you know, critical part of the mission. So, you know, we've been part of that whole process over the years of making sure that these things work on orbit and we can get them right first time. And we've been very lucky, because when you do follow that process, things generally work. And I think there are very few instances where we've been involved in programs and they really haven't. So we've been very fortunate in that respect. You know, that there have been failed launches and other problems, but I think we've got a pretty good track record, and one that we hope to maintain, of course.
Yeah, hopefully. So what are the kind of typical timescales of that kind of project? So say what you've been doing, say something you've been working recently with SPICE, for example.
Yeah, so SPICE in the end was about a four-year mission.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, missions sort of target a program of 3 years. We, mm-hmm. you know, they do on occasion experience problems. We had our own problems.
Mm-hmm.
But again, part of the job is following that problem through to a solution, and you know, with good engineering, hopefully you'll get there.
Yeah.
And you'll deliver something that works. And I think, thankfully, as a result of going through that program, we flushed out a few other things that we maybe could improve as well. And in the main, I think space programs often don't allow enough time for iteration and, mm-hmm. and development, really. It's better now. I think there was a time about 10 years ago where everyone wanted to do it leaner and quicker, but I don't think that really worked quite that way. So, yeah, a three-year mission is generally sort of standard. A three-year development is generally standard. But for a big program like a Hubble or a James Webb or a BepiColombo, Colombo, which has been in the news this week, you know, those are technologically demanding, and there's a whole program of development work that feeds into that spacecraft sort of detailed design program. So again, we get involved in that kind of thing. So maybe within the last decade, you could be working on James Webb, which would be operating at 35 Kelvin, and in the afternoon you'd be working on BepiColombo, which would be sort of 350 degrees C, you know, and then those are kind of the two extremes that we've, you know, been working on recently. So you've got infrared, which needs the cold, and then you've got BepiColombo, which is of course going to Mercury, and things get very hot there. So.
Yeah, that sounds fantastically varied. So could you give us a taste of some of the kind of challenges you faced on working on one of these missions?
Yeah, so the challenge is really, I mean, we do sort of get involved in programs where the lifetime, for example, is a challenge, and our lubricants have to last for the mission duration. You know, and it might be a bearing that has to rotate at a certain speed for a certain number of years, and you know, really, you're looking at the main aspects are the environment, so it's in vacuum. Increasingly, ground testing is a big thing. So, whereas you maybe got away 10 years ago with a much shorter on-ground budget, you now have to develop something to you know, that can be used for more calibration activities. There's people who just want to do more testing, they want to prove things. But that comes at a cost, and some lubricants which work very well in vacuum don't necessarily work very well in air or the nitrogen environment that we sometimes use. And it also places constraints on the spacecraft engineers. You know, if you're testing a satellite, you might have to, you know, give it some kind of nitrogen purge to protect the bearings, or even test it in certain orientations sometimes. That can make a difference. That's a big constraint on the person building the satellite.
That's right. I thought you were going to say something. It's fine. And so when you're creating these tests on Earth, obviously you can create a near vacuum and you can approximate the temperatures, but you can't create zero G. Is that something you have to take into account, and does it impact the performance of anything? I'm not sure how it would, but I just thought I'd ask.
Yeah, zero G, I've actually been asked that quite a lot this week, whether we do any tests on the ISS or on a zero G plane or anything. It's quite an easily quantifiable effect. So in some cases we can make allowances for perhaps a little bit of extra load on a bearing, for example, that we're testing. In general, it's not something we do, but there are obviously uncertainties related to it. So, and particularly with liquid lubricants, on occasions we use greases and oils, and obviously those, if they're sitting for a long time in vacuum on Earth, you know, there's a gravitational effect to how those will migrate within the hardware. So keeping your oil in the right place in the bearing is a big challenge, and obviously gravity has an influence in that, but it's generally not something we've really had to focus too much on. But there's certainly areas and questions that could be answered, and I think, yeah, it's probably not the top priority right now, but there are certainly areas where it could be.
And what is the top priority?
Yeah, I think on the solid lubrication side, we're looking to improve that balance between testing in vacuum and testing in air. I think there's very much a customer demand for that, and it influences much more of the higher volume commercial stuff. I think with the real extremes of missions duration, you know, they tend to be one-off science missions, and therefore there's not the demand in the industry for that. So, and ultimately it's that demand that pays the bills, really. And the money has to come from somewhere, and you know, it has to be a big problem to spend that kind of money on solving it, really. And that's the reality of what we do sometimes. It's, you know,
I was going to say, so what other industries does your work apply to?
Well, we really can add a lot to any vacuum industry, really. Mm-hmm. You know, we're quite unique in that we've got a huge body of test data from 45 years. Probably one of our most successful space spin-outs has been into the medical industry. So we provide a huge amount of bearing lubricated lubrication products to the medical industry. So they go into MRI scanners and things. So if you've been in an MRI scanner at any time, mm-hmm. The chances are, more likely than not, they've got a bearing with our lubrication in. And originally the problem there was that the bearings were awfully noisy. Mm-hmm. The noisy places are the best of times, but
yes.
I think they were exceptionally noisy before we got involved. Mm-hmm. And we developed a coating based on silver, so a very thin film of silver, less than a micron thick. And that's that coating is what provides the reliable sort of smooth rotation of those bearings. It's still not in general terms that smooth, but it's certainly better than what they had.
So next time I have an MRI scan, I'll be keeping that in mind. Yeah.
I bought my dog in the morning, and I pass one every day, actually, local hospital. So I think about that every time I see it.
Well, no, but that's great to see that it's kind of the same science and engineering you're putting through. Like, I mean, obviously the situation is very different and there's, you know, slightly different problems you have to think about. But that's fantastic to see the applicability of it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there are other industries. I mean, increasingly we're getting a little bit involved in fusion energy. So people are interested in that. I mean, these are big long-term programs and there's so many material developments that are required. But in terms of the remote handling there, you know, you have to operate this fusion reactor for maybe 20 years. And at the end of it, you want to decommission it robotically. And you want to know that a screw is going to come out. And that, again, that's a lubrication problem, really. So we're looking at our lubricants for that purpose as well.
And that's really long term. Like, I never stop and think that everyone has to think about this before they start.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the... That's the beauty of what we do, actually. And probably the best bit for me on working on these big programs is just the all the people that come together with their skills. And after, you know, what is essentially a big bun fight, you come out at the end with something that's really amazing. And you know, I think that's the challenge for me, just bringing that whole systems engineering together to create something that's probably much better than you thought you could achieve at the start. So there's a bit of give and take involved. But it's, you know, it's that collaboration, I think, that's probably the most rewarding part. That and launching a spacecraft and seeing those images come back a few years later. That's always nice.
That is, pretty incredible. So how did you even get into this?
For me personally, I probably wasn't one of those people that grew up really thinking that's what I want to do. At university, I developed an interest in optics, and then also an interest in sort of dynamic testing, vibration, and things like that. And I think just those interests came together in a way that was just really lent itself to developing spacecraft instruments. So I went to work at the Rutherford Appleton Laboratory in Oxfordshire after I graduated. And after spending time there, which was really fascinating, I worked on some great projects. I think there was an element of lots of big projects and not too many people to work on them. So you got sort of, you know, dropped headfirst into some pretty amazing things. Within a few weeks of being there, I was working on Beagle, which is nice, and it launched very quickly afterwards. I mean, it's quite rare for anybody, I think, to get involved as a graduate on something that essentially flies so quickly afterwards. And then within 18 months, it landed on Mars. And as we know now, it has survived. So that was obviously a long wait to find that out. So that was great. And then after several years of working there, I saw this opportunity came up in Warrington, and so that was working on spacecraft mechanisms, and I think that was quite attractive to me. You might have guessed that I'm originally from the north, so there's a bit of sort of thinking about that, and so that sort of influenced my decision. I came up and really haven't looked back. It's mechanism engineering is, you know, some critical stuff there. It's the sharp end. There's nowhere to hide. You know, you can't blag your way out of the problems we have. So I quite like that. You know, it sorts out the, I think it really challenges your engineering skills. And you have to be right. You can't, it's not like being a politician. You can't win the argument and be wrong. You have to use your judgment, win the argument, and be right, and your reputation depends on it. And I'm really lucky to work with a bunch of really committed, experienced people who, you know, have really devoted a lot of time to understanding this, and it's quite nice to be part of a team like that. And I think overall, you know, the space industry is full of people like that, so anyone thinking, you know, about working in engineering, you know, it there are a lot of committed people that are really focused on, you know, doing the job and doing the right thing. And the things that come out from it are really, you know, really good. You know, whether it's looking at climate change, whether it's planetary exploration, science, you know, there's some really great benefits to society from doing this. Not, you know, that helps. Helps you sleep at night.
I would say, in my opinion, engineers are the unsung heroes of science, genuinely, because all of those fantastic pictures we see from the Hubble and those telescopes wouldn't be there without you.
Yeah, I think that's certainly true. I think we could always do more to celebrate our successes. I think that's probably true. Often those successes come a long time after doing the work, and we're already on to the new thing that interests us. Engineers are probably some of the worst people for that, and myself included, probably. And yeah, I think this it's very rewarding, though, and I think a lot of people are very sort of self-satisfied, and you know, it's quite a rewarding career. But you're right, we have to sell it to the next generation, don't we? Otherwise, you know, I think we all lose out.
Yeah, well, it's been great to speak to you, and I had a fantastic insight into what you do. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Yeah.